Welcome to our deep dive this time into how cities in India changed during the period of British rule.
Yeah, we're going to be looking at it from 1757 to 1947.
Okay.
And we're going to be using historical accounts
Right.
and economic analyses to kind of really dig into and peel back the layers of this.
Really get into it, yeah.
Really get into it. Yeah, so think about it. Like, we're all getting in a time machine.
Okay.
We're going to be walking the streets of Calcutta.
Wow.
Madras, as they were being transformed.
During colonial rule.
Yeah, by British rule.
So this is a big one.
It's a big one. It's a fascinating one.
Yeah.
But it's a really complex story.
It is.
And we're really going to uncover how the physical changes to the urban landscape are intertwined with power.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Dynamics.
That was a great point.
Cultural clashes, and really the very birth of modern India.
All right, so let's start with the East India Company in those early days.
Okay.
They weren't exactly, you know, seasoned empire builders.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
Initially, their knowledge of India was pretty much solely limited to trade.
Right.
They focused on establishing trading posts on the coast, often with very little understanding of local languages and customs.
Right.
So you could almost say that they kind of stumbled into an empire.
They fell into.
Fell into it.
Wow.
But then they had to make this really kind of big switch from trading to actually governing this vast and complex society.
Right, which is a huge undertaking.
It was a steep learning curve, for sure.
Right.
It was unique even within the British Empire as it stood at the time.
Right.
But there is one figure who kind of stands out from this early period.
Okay.
And that's Warren Hastings.
Okay.
Now, he was fluent in Persian.
Oh, wow.
And he was familiar with Indian culture, which gave him a very unique advantage.
Okay, so he was kind of like an anomaly among these early...
Like, it's a bit of an anomaly.
Company agents, yeah.
Yeah.
So how did the British government react to the company's, you know, expanding role?
Well, they realized that things were getting a little bit out of hand.
Yeah. And so they stepped in with a series of what were called regulating acts.
Yeah.
Aimed at bringing the company under much tighter control.
Okay.
And they emphasized this idea that they were ruling as trustees for the people of India.
Trustees. That's an interesting term.
It is.
What did that mean in practice?
Well, in theory, it meant that they were obligated to act in the best interests of the Indian people.
Okay.
However, the reality often fell short of this ideal.
Right.
The company's primary focus remained on profit and consolidating its own power.
So a disconnect between the rhetoric and the...
A little bit of a disconnect.
Reality, yeah.
Yeah.
And to further solidify that control, they established the Board of Control.
Yes, in 1783.
1783, right.
Which brought the company under the direct oversight of the British government.
Okay.
So that really shaped the course of British involvement in India.
It did. So let's talk about the infrastructure projects that the British undertook. Okay. They really did leave their mark.
They were extensive, their projects.
You've got to think about these vast railway networks that they built.
Yeah.
Spanning thousands of miles.
Thousands of miles of rail.
Connecting different parts of the country in ways that had never been seen before.
Wow.
You've also got the modern water and sanitation systems that were installed in major cities.
Right.
And those grand administrative buildings designed very much in a European style that still stand to this day.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing the feats of engineering.
Absolutely incredible.
That they were able to pull off.
Yeah.
But what was the real driving force?
Well, I mean, this is where the colonial agenda really comes into play.
Right.
So while these projects did bring some benefits,
of course,
they were primarily designed to serve British interests.
Right.
So if you think about the railways, for example,
yeah,
they facilitated troop movements.
Right.
And the movement of resources.
Which is essential for maintaining.
Which is essential for maintaining control.
Yeah. Control over such a vast territory.
So it was about connecting India, but on their terms. Exactly.
And how about the development of cities like Calcutta and Madras?
So these port cities became vital hubs for trade and administration.
Right.
Calcutta especially emerged as the capital of British India.
Wow.
And it really showcased the grandeur and the power of the empire.
Yeah.
These cities were meticulously planned and developed, reflecting the British vision of a modern, efficient urban space.
But was that modernization experienced in the same way by all residents?
That's the key question.
Right.
There's a stark contrast between the opulence of the European enclaves,
okay,
which were known as civil lines,
oh, okay,
and the often very crowded and difficult conditions in the Indian neighborhoods.
Okay.
So these civil lines boasted paved roads,
uh-huh,
well-maintained parks,
right.
exclusive clubs, a far cry from the reality of life for many people.
Outside of those zones, right?
Outside of those zones.
So the physical layout of the city was reflecting the power dynamics.
Exactly.
At play.
It wasn't just about modernizing. It was about shaping the city in their image.
Wow.
And controlling the movement and the lives of its inhabitants.
So spatial segregation was a deliberate strategy.
A deliberate strategy to establish hierarchy.
Right.
And reinforce British dominance.
It's a reminder that these infrastructure projects, you know, even though they can seem objective on the surface,
yeah,
they are really intertwined with power.
Absolutely.
And control.
Yeah.
This wasn't a story of just, you know, unchallenged British dominance, though, right?
Oh, no, no, no.
There was resistance.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We can't talk about colonial India without acknowledging figures like Tipu Sultan.
Okay.
Now, he ruled the kingdom of Mysore in the late 18th century.
Okay.
And he fiercely resisted British advances.
Okay.
What's really fascinating about Tipu Sultan is that he not only modernized his own army.
Wow.
He incorporated European tactics.
Okay.
He also actively sought alliances with the French.
Wow.
He recognized the strategic importance of global politics.
So he was a formidable opponent.
He was a formidable opponent.
But ultimately, he was defeated in 1799.
He was.
What does that tell us about this era?
Well, it really highlights the growing strength and the determination of the British. But it also served as a rallying point for future resistance movements.
Right.
His story became a symbol of defiance against colonial rule.
Right.
And it really is a reminder that that desire for freedom and self-determination was burning bright.
Yeah, it's fascinating how these stories are all intertwined.
It is.
And connected.
Yeah, and you can see these threads throughout history.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
We've been talking about all this infrastructure and the resistance to it.
Yeah.
But let's kind of go a little deeper now into the actual fabric of these cities.
Yeah.
That were rapidly transforming. You know, how did daily life change for the people?
Yeah.
Living amidst all this modernization.
Well, imagine like a ripple effect.
Okay.
Starting from the economic core of these urban centers. The introduction of all these new industries and this kind of integration of India into this global market had a massive impact on people's traditional livelihoods.
Yeah. So it wasn't just new buildings and railways.
No.
It was like a whole new way of life.
A whole new way of life. Yeah.
What kind of changes were people experiencing?
Well, think about it.
Right.
The artisans and craftsmen.
Right.
Who had thrived for generations.
Right.
Suddenly they're facing all this competition from mass-produced goods.
Coming in from Britain.
Coming in from Britain. Yeah. Yeah. Their skills, which had always been so highly valued, were now struggling to find a place in this new economy.
It's hard to adapt to all that.
And it is a huge adaptation.
So that must have been incredibly disruptive.
Oh, absolutely incredibly disruptive for these communities.
Were there any opportunities popping up alongside all these challenges?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Oh. The colonial economy created a demand for new types of labor. You had factories and workshops kind of springing up everywhere, offering jobs in manufacturing and processing.
Okay.
And this drew people from rural areas seeking a better life in the cities.
So contributing to that rapid urbanization.
Exactly. Yeah. Big population growth in the cities.
It's amazing how those shifts, you know, not just changed the buildings, but also changed the social landscape.
Completely.
We can't forget about colonial education policy.
No, absolutely not.
Especially the whole push for English language education.
That's a key point.
Yeah.
The introduction of English created a whole new class of Indians who were fluent in the language of the rulers.
Of the rulers, right.
So this opened doors for them in the administration and the economy.
Right.
But it also created a very stark divide.
So it's both empowerment and exclusion.
Yeah, exactly.
At the same time.
Exactly. While some benefited, many others were left behind.
Without access.
Without access. No. This educational divide had lasting consequences.
Yeah.
It contributed to social stratification and really shaped the future of independent India.
It's a reminder that progress doesn't always come without a cost.
Exactly.
And the benefits aren't evenly distributed.
No, they're definitely not.
But amidst all this change, something else was brewing.
Oh, yeah.
The seeds of Indian nationalism.
Uh-huh.
How did this movement begin to take root?
Well, think about it. Cities were becoming these melting pots of ideas.
Yeah.
Indians were exposed to Western education and political thought.
Right.
And they began to question colonial rule.
That makes sense.
This idea of self-determination really began to resonate.
Having a voice.
Yeah, having a voice.
In their own governance.
Yeah, their own future.
Yeah. Did this lead to any kind of organized movements?
Absolutely. You see the emergence of these early nationalist organizations,
okay,
like the Indian Association and the Mahajana Sabha, providing platforms for Indians to kind of articulate their grievances,
right,
advocate for more autonomy.
So they were laying the groundwork for the independence movement. That would come later.
Yeah. And what's really fascinating is while these groups were promoting this unified Indian identity,
right,
colonial policies often exacerbated existing divisions.
You're talking about divide and rule.
Exactly. That classic divide and rule.
Yeah.
They played different communities against each other.
Right.
Exploiting religion and caste differences.
Right.
To maintain control.
To maintain their grip on power.
Exactly. And we can see this even in the way they structured municipal elections.
Okay.
Under Lord Ripon.
Wasn't Ripon known for his liberal policies?
He was. He genuinely believed in promoting universal loyalties.
Okay.
And expanding local governance.
Right.
But the electoral system he implemented unintentionally reinforced these divisions by allocating seats based on religious and caste affiliations.
So his well-intentioned reforms
had
unintended consequences.
Unintended consequences. It's a classic example of how colonial policies, even those aimed at progress, could backfire.
And deepen those fault lines?
Deepen those fault lines.
We've covered a lot of ground here.
We have.
From economic shifts to the rise of nationalism.
Yeah.
It's clear this period was a huge turning point.
Huge turning point.
In India's urban history.
Absolutely.
Before we move on to the legacy of all of this,
okay,
let's just take a moment to kind of reflect on what we've learned so far.
Okay.
You know, we're dealing with a really complex and nuanced history.
We are, yeah.
There are no easy answers or simple narratives.
Nope.
We need to consider multiple perspectives.
Yeah.
And go deeper than the surface level.
Absolutely. And that's what makes it so fascinating.
That's what makes this deep dive so interesting.
Yeah.
It's not just reciting facts and figures.
No.
It's about understanding the forces that shape these cities and continue to influence them to this day.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We've talked about the changes to India's cities during British rule, all the infrastructure projects, the social upheaval, the rise of nationalism.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the legacy of this modernization. What can we still see of that era in India's cities today?
Well, it's like walking through a living museum, you know?
Okay.
You've got the physical remnants of the colonial period everywhere you look.
Yeah.
From the grand railway stations to those really imposing government buildings.
Right.
Often designed in a style that was specifically meant to evoke a sense of authority and power.
Yeah, they're not just buildings, are they?
No, they're not.
They're tangible reminders.
Well, they are.
Of a complex past.
Absolutely.
So they're like echoes of an era.
Yeah.
That continue to shape the landscape.
That continue to shape the landscape, yeah.
But what about the impact on urban planning?
Yeah.
And just the social fabric of these cities.
Well, think about that spatial segregation that we talked about.
Uh-huh.
The creation of those civil lines.
Right.
And the stark contrast between European and Indian neighborhoods.
Right.
Those divisions weren't just erased when India gained independence.
Right.
They've often morphed and evolved.
Right.
And they've influenced patterns of housing.
Right.
Access to amenities and even social interactions.
So the ghost of colonial urban planning is still there.
It's still there lurking.
In a way.
Yeah.
So how did these legacies play out in the contemporary challenges that Indian cities face?
Well, it's complex.
Okay.
I mean, the infrastructure that was built during the colonial period, while impressive,
right,
wasn't always designed with the needs of this rapidly growing independent nation in mind.
So it's a strain on the system.
Yeah, it can lead to strains on the existing infrastructure.
And these cities are dealing with overpopulation.
Huge population.
Limited resources.
Absolutely.
It's like they're trying to adapt a system.
Yeah.
That was designed for a different era.
For a different time and a different place.
To the demands of the 21st century.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you've got those social and economic disparities that have been made worse.
Exacerbated.
By these patterns of development.
Yeah, so the educational divide, for instance, continues to have an impact on opportunity.
And social mobility.
And social mobility, absolutely.
So while modernization did bring progress,
of course,
it also created some of the challenges that India is facing today.
Yeah, that's the key takeaway here.
Okay.
This legacy of colonialism, it's a double-edged sword.
Yeah.
We can't ignore the negatives, but we have to acknowledge the contributions that it made.
To India's development.
India's development, yeah.
It's about understanding that this history is not just something in a textbook.
No.
It's shaping the lives of millions of people.
Absolutely. And that's why engaging with this history is so important.
Right.
You know, it helps us make sense of the present.
Yeah.
And it informs the choices that we make about the future.
Absolutely. So as we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave our listeners with a final thought.
Okay.
You know, the colonial period might be over.
Yeah.
But urbanization and modernization continue.
They do. How can we learn from the mistakes of the past?
Yeah.
To create cities that are more equitable and sustainable.
That's the challenge.
That's the big challenge.
And the opportunity.
It is a huge opportunity as well.
So thank you for joining us on this journey.
It's been a pleasure.
Through the urban history of colonial India.
Yeah.
We hope this deep dive has sparked your curiosity.
I hope so.
And given you new insights into the forces that shaped these vibrant and complex cities.
It's been fascinating.
Until next time.